perennial subject for us here on Issues, Etc. We come back around to it again and again. It's probably significant that the 4th of July is going to roll around here in about a month and a half. And as we get closer to Independence Day and the flag waving and the patriotism that accompanies that national holiday, the question will come up again. Is America a Christian nation? Has it ever been a Christian nation? Well, that's a question, one of the questions taken up in a recent book by John Meacham, who is managing editor of Newsweek. The book is called American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. Earlier this afternoon, I had an opportunity to talk with John about his book and about religion in the Founding Fathers and religion in today's American public life. We'll be playing that interview for you here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Our call-in numbers for the next 3 hours, we are coming to you live this Monday, the 15th of May, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. You can use that in-studio email address. We'll see if Joni can check the email for us, because Jeff, yeah, that's his name. Jeff is out of town for today, and Joni will be given the added task. Can you do that, Joni? Check the email? We'll see. Craig, you go show her how to check the email. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. We'll take your questions and comments throughout these 3 hours via the email as well. After this half-hour conversation with John Meacham, Dr. James Veltz joins us. He'll be with us until 4:30. We're going to talk about the canonical gospels, that is, the four gospels we find in the New Testament, versus the Gnostic gospels, Gospel of Judas, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary. There's all sorts of those things floating around out there. How did we get the New Testament canon, the set of books that are accepted to be the New Testament? Did it happen the way Dan Brown says it happened? That there were all these competing gospels very early on from all different perspectives on Jesus, some saying he's divine, some saying he isn't, some portraying Christianity as a goddess religion, some not. But then about 4th century, the newly Christian emperor Constantine decided that he wanted his viewpoint to prevail, and he called a council, and next thing you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's all we're left with. That's what Dan Brown says. Is that how it actually happened? Dr. James Veltz will answer that question, and then at 4:30, we'll spend some time with Jennifer Roback Morse talking about gay marriage and no-fault divorce. There is a connection between these two things, and in the last hour of the program, from 5 to 6, I was driving out to Steelville, Illinois, and thank you very much to the congregation of Steelville, St. Mark's in Steelville with Pastor Janicki, for having me out this weekend, Saturday night and Sunday morning, to preach there. They were very hospitable, but I was driving out there early in the morning and almost blew through one of these small towns at top speed because I was listening to a very interesting interview on the BBC. The thing that interested me was not only the subject, it was on abortion. But the guest, Greg Kokel, who's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., he did about a half-hour interview on a program in the morning on BBC on Sunday called The Interview, and we're going to play that for you. Stop and start. Get your reaction in the last half-hour of Issues, Etc. Get a chance to see Greg do what he does best, which is respond. You know, when I talk to him, we agree on abortion. You get a chance to listen to him respond to an interviewer who very definitely does not agree with him on abortion and throws everything but the kitchen sink, well, maybe even the kitchen sink, at him, and you'll get to hear his responses in the last hour of Issues, Etc. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk with John Meacham. He's written this book, and he's been all over the media. The book is called American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. I began by talking with him and asking him, are religious conservatives today more influential in American public life and politics than ever before in American history?
I don't. I think that religious conservatives, and at different eras, religious liberals, have had great influence throughout the course of our history. Obviously, the civil rights movement is a huge example. The temperance movement is a huge example. Going back, abolition, a huge example. So my sense is that there's a fairly steady continuum of religious influence in the lives, the political life of the nation, and that anyone who would denounce or want to limit religious influence needs to understand that it's been this way for a very long time.
So what's different today? The perception is, and it's certainly portrayed very often in kind of popular media, that religious conservatism has more influence, more sway in the last several decades, maybe since the Reagan era, than any time before. What's different about it today, John?
Well, my theory is that on the left, secular folks feel surrounded, in part because it's been 40 years since the high water mark of post-war American liberalism, since 1965, the Great Society, the Civil, the Voting Rights Act, and the two presidents the Democratic Party has managed to elect in those 40 years were both Southern Baptists who were centrists, essentially, when they were elected, and did not deliver on the great promises of the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Great Society. At the same time, I have to say, you even see there's a story in the New York Times this morning about how Dr. Dobson and others are concerned that the White House is not following through on promises that it made in 2004. So you have on the right, I think, a sense sometimes that they are beleaguered in a way, that believers are under siege from the larger culture and politicians. And I think that's because, really, if you date the beginning of the modern religious right, as I do, from the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973, the two central demands of the movement, a pro-life amendment to the Constitution and a restitution of school prayer into the public schools, have not been met. So I think many religious people are looking around today. The occasion is the same-sex marriage ban amendment to the Constitution, are looking around and really wondering, what have we gotten out of this now 35-year dance with politicians? And that draws on an ancient tradition of religious people not being entirely trustworthy of the vicissitudes of politics and the world.
The contention is often made by those on the religious right that America was founded as, or still is in some sense, a Christian nation. They will often, in fact, you write about the intensity with which the religious right attempts to constrict the founders into their causes. How would you answer that question? Is America, or has it ever been, a Christian nation?
I would argue against it on both historical and theological grounds. Historically, we were founded by men who were, in fact, Christian. They were very unorthodox. They were not what we would think of today as evangelical Christians at all. And they were explicitly trying to avoid making us a nation which spiritual power and temporal power would be joined together, because every time it had been joined together in the history of man, it had come out badly when you mixed God and the power of the state. And so they were trying to avoid that. And also, I'm an Episcopalian, I'm a Christian, not a very good one, but I try. I would argue against it on theological grounds, that you cannot have a Christian nation because, as St. Paul said, God is no respecter of peoples or nations. As it says in the Epistle to the Hebrews, we have no lasting city, but seek the city which is to come. Jesus said to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, then would my servants fight. So my sense, theologically, is that the only Christian nation is the kingdom of God, and it's not here yet. And it is a sin of enormous pride and even blasphemy to assume that anything on this side of paradise can be presented as a Christian nation. And I think I base that on the reading of Scripture.
So my sense here is that, and this is how I've come to look at the founders and their religious, the influence of religion there, is that the founders very consciously borrowed on Christian capital, but they themselves had no intention of founding anything like a Christian nation. But they were happy to borrow on the principles, the morals, the philosophical underpinnings of a Christian culture.
I completely agree with that. They were working from a, it was Judeo-Christian, because Christianity itself, obviously, is grew out of Judaism. The idea in Genesis that we were all made in the image and likeness of God, that all men are created equal, that we were made by nature's God, by the Creator, with those inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that was a religious idea. Now, they could have framed it in another way. They could have made it a more secular point, but they didn't. They consciously chose, Jefferson consciously chose, and he was the most unorthodox of Christians, as you know. You know, he took a razor to the Gospels and cut out the miracles. So he was not your Sunday school poster boy by any means. But he chose to ground our fundamental human rights in the divine, and I think he did it so in order to lift them out of the temporal sphere and make them completely protected on the principle that what God had given, no man could take away. As he said, the God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. And I think you have to take that language seriously if you want to argue, to go back one question, as I would do, and it sounds as though as you would do, that we're not a Christian nation, in part because there's that phrase doesn't pop up in any of the founding documents. And they had the founders had every opportunity to use Christian imagery and Christian language, or sectarian imagery and sectarian language, and they didn't. So you can't have it both ways. I mean, if you're going to take the documents as they're written, you have to take them as they're written. And my strong belief is that, based on history, they just thought getting into sectarian religious politics was a recipe for disaster. They were growing up in the shadow of England, where Henry VIII had taken a Catholic nation one day, made it entirely Anglican, then Mary took it back to being entirely Catholic, and then it ended up under Elizabeth being a little bit of both, all in the span of just a few decades, and a lot of people lost their heads, literally, along the way. And they just realized that was no way to run a railroad. And so they wanted to enshrine liberty of conscience, liberty of choice, to believe what one would want to believe or not believe. And they did it on both political and religious grounds.
We're talking with John Meacham, managing editor of Newsweek, and he's author of the new book, American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. We're talking about religion in the Founding Fathers. What is America's public religion today? You use that phrase several times in the book, America's public religion.
I do use the phrase. I borrow it from Benjamin Franklin, who talked about the necessity of a public religion to the maintenance of the morality of a nation. My argument is that our public religion is a religion based on a belief in the God we were just talking about, nature's God, the Creator, the figure in the Declaration of Independence who made the world and made all of us. And to use the founders' language and idea, it is a God who created the world, who works in the world through providence, who is attentive to history, who cares about the United States, and who will reward or punish us one day, in John Adams' phrase, in another life for our conduct in this. Now, very seriously, religious people, Christians, Jews, Muslims, any number of traditions, will say, well, you can't have a God of public religion, a God of In God We Trust, or One Nation Under God, or God Bless America, and have it God the Father, the Holy Trinity, or the God of Abraham. They would argue that that's idolatry. Perhaps in a very narrow, in the most stringent scholarly religious sense, that may be true. My sense is that in a fallen world, in a world of storm and strife, in a world that is inevitably going to disappoint us, the compromise of having a God at the center of the national experience, whom presidents can evoke, whom the nation can, in times of crisis and of tranquility and of celebration, can rally round, which we see time and time again. What was the central song? The central thing that people sang after September 11th, it was God Bless America. Well, that God had to be as broad a God as possible to include as many people as possible in order to be a figure of unity and not division. And I think the trade-off of having that as an organizing principle is worth it. I don't think it's God the Father of the Trinity. I don't think it's the God of Abraham. I think it's this God that the founders had in mind, who was nature's God, who had made the world. And I know that it will upset some of my friends who are strong believers, but I think in public life you have to make certain trade-offs, and that's a trade-off worth making.
Just two final questions here, John. How do you assess President Bush's public administration of America's public religion?
I think the president is fully within the mainstream of the history of presidential religious rhetoric. I think that people who object to his allusions to the Almighty probably are doing so because they have many other objections to his policies, and they focused on that because it's particularly sellable, I guess, in the public square. It's an easy charge to say, well, George Bush is trying to make us a theocracy because he talks about God all the time. That, to me, represents a woeful lack of understanding of the history of the country, in which virtually every president and virtually every major public figure has long invoked this God and has seen us as a nation in which the power of providence is quite strong.
And how would you evaluate, we talked before about the religious right, and that's usually what is discussed whenever people talk about religion in public life, but how would you evaluate the strength of the religious left in America?
It's growing, I think, or it wants to grow, let me put it that way. I have four books sitting on my desk, four manuscripts that are coming out in the next 4 or 5 months, of arguing for a more progressive, more center-left, religious political sensibility. And I think it's interesting that it took this long, frankly, for so many left of center Christians to realize that they had to argue in religious terms on a religious battlefield in many ways politically to if they wanted to try to control or at least get an equal hearing in terms of the national conversation. I hesitate when one talks about the civil rights movement, which was such a remarkable example of America at her best, of individual people changing the destiny of the nation, of martyrs suffering, literally in the tradition of St. Stephen, of shedding their blood for their beliefs. I hate to talk about that in sort of simple left-right terms, but what Martin Luther King, what John Lewis, what Andy Young, what Ralph Abernathy, those three civil rights workers in Neshoba County, the little girls in Birmingham, what all of them had in common was a belief that America had been founded with a promise of equality, that God had made us all equal, and we were all entitled to equal dignity and respect. And it is our finest hour, including the defeat of Nazis, of totalitarianism abroad, and of institutionalized racism at home, were the great achievements of the 20th century. And both were driven in part by religious motivations. And so religion can be a force for great good, left or right. And I think it's just a matter of looking at it case by case, day by day, and knowing that this world is always going to be disappointing to us, but the best we can hope for is that the religion that we have can be used as a force for good and not for evil in a world that is immensely complicated and full of snares.
Before I let you go, can you sort something out for me? This is just a question that always rolls around in my head whenever we talk about religion in public life. At least if you use the examples of, say, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, they were both at least publicly perceived as more liberal in their political leanings, but were members of a more conservative church body, the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at, say, the last, President Bush and his father, both are members of what are perceived to be kind of mainline liberal Protestant denominations, and yet politically, we're more conservative. How do you explain that kind of seeming flip-flop between these presidents in their public political life and in their private religious affiliation?
That's a terrific question. I think it's less about Sunday morning and more about the other 6 days of the week. I think that people look at the coalitions that elect these presidents, look at the policies they pursue, the people who surround them, and I think reach their decisions, their impressions about one's religiosity or lack thereof based on the workaday week as opposed to Sunday morning. And what I would argue is that President Carter and President Clinton have very interesting religious theological lives. Both of them have talked about faith in very interesting and important ways, as has President Bush, both President Bushes, and as did President Reagan. And that's an example, I think, of why and how religion can be a force for good. That two Democratic presidents who hold positions, policy positions, that were wildly divergent from many of their co-religionists could still hold them. And one of the great things about America is that you can believe what you want to believe. And we can argue about things and fight them out and duke it out, but we do it as members of the same family. And as Senator McCain said this last weekend at Liberty, let's just make sure all our arguments are always arguments among friends. And I think those are wise words for all of us.
John Meacham is managing editor of Newsweek. He's author of the new book, American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. John, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, great thing about this book is that it, what it does is really establish from the original documents themselves, but also from the private writings of the Founding Fathers and the cloud of men around the Founding Fathers, what they intended to do and how they intended religion to fit into public life. You know, it was America's called an experiment in democracy. But part of that experiment was saying, look, what we encountered in the old world, we don't want to repeat in the new. And so they very consciously crafted a place for a religion in American public life. Never a perfect solution, but certainly not the one that many people say it is. Founding Fathers sitting down with Bible in hand, opening it up and saying, how do we make a nation? That simply didn't happen. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking about the canonical Gospels, the Gospels you find in the New Testament, versus many other Gospels that are out there. You can read some of those just by going to Barnes & Noble or to Walden Books. You can find things like the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Mary. You'll have people talking about them all the time. Dan Brown says that we got the New Testament. It was really a political fight. And Emperor Constantine forced his will on the rest of the church, had a bunch of Gospels put away and suppressed and leaving only four. Is that how it really happened? We'll talk about that with Dr. James Vells right after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. What impact do teachings like creation, the fall into sin, the cross of Christ, law and gospel, simultaneously saint and sinner, the Word of God, baptism, and the Lord's Supper have on everyday life? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is titled A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about A Theology to Live By on our website, issuesetc.org. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Luther's theology is not abstract speculation, but teaching with a practical application for the real Christian life. A Theology to Live By, Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian, by Herman Preuss. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Why are pregnancy centers under attack from pro-abortion politicians and the ACLU?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Abortion advocates in Congress recently filed legislation threatening to shut down pregnancy centers they say are engaging in false advertising. The alleged crime? Informing women about alternatives to abortion and serving as competition to abortion businesses. An attorney who advises pregnancy centers put it this way: the real fraudulent activity comes from those in the abortion industry who want to withhold truthful information. Abortion advocates know that when informed about alternatives to abortion, women often choose life. That's not false advertising. That's simply full disclosure.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Every person of observation has remarked that the times are pregnant with great events. The political world has undergone changes stupendous, unexpected, and calculated to inspire thoughtful men with the most boding anticipations. True today, those words are 190 years old. The opening words of an address to the people of the United States read on the steps of New York City Hall, May 13, 1816. The address announced the founding of the American Bible Society. An excitement, as extraordinary as it is powerful, has roused the nations to the importance of spreading the knowledge of the one living and true God as revealed in His Son, the mediator between God and men, Christ Jesus. The historical importance of the Bible cause was demonstrated by those who have served the American Bible Society as officers, four chief justices of the Supreme Court, President John Quincy Adams, and other notables like Francis Scott Key. The benefits of the Bible are as important today as back in the early days of our nation. Said the address, "What instrument has the Lord thought fit chiefly to use? That which contributes, in all latitudes and climes, to make Christians feel their unity, to rebuke the spirit of strife, and to open upon them the day of brotherly concord. The Bible. The Bible." Happy birthday, American Bible Society.
A year ago, St. Louis celebrated the 40th anniversary of the completion of Eero Saarinen's Gateway Arch. In the video documentary, Monumental Reflections, Channel 9's Patrick Murphy explores how this monument has developed meanings far beyond being a symbol of westward expansion. The Missouri Historical Society is pleased to co-sponsor the first public screening of this new documentary. It will be Thursday, May 25th, 7 o'clock, at the Missouri History Museum. Admission is free.
The only thing fictional in the Da Vinci Code is the characters and the action that takes place. All of the locations, the paintings, the ancient history, the secret documents, the rituals, all of this is factual.
That's Dan Brown, author of the now famous book, The Da Vinci Code, talking about the facts and the fiction in his novel. At the very heart of Dan Brown's fiction is a claim he says is fact. And it has a lot to do with what Christianity, he says, really was. Not what it is, but what it really was, who Jesus really was, and what books really should Christians have been reading all along that they haven't been reading. He says there's a whole number of them, and that the true nature of Christianity has been lost, not just to history, but he says it's been lost and covered up by conspiracy. We're not going to focus so much on his alleged conspiracy as on the truth of the New Testament, the truth of how we got the New Testament books, and the truth as opposed to the fiction in Dan Brown's novel. Here during this hour of Issues Etc., I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back. Our guest here in Studio A to talk about the canonical Gospels, those Gospels we find in the New Testament versus the Gnostic Gospels, and many of the claims made and surrounding Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, Dr. James Veltz. He's professor of New Testament and director of graduate studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He will be one of the speakers for a special presentation titled Discernment for Da Vinci tomorrow night at 7 at Werner Auditorium here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. Dr. Veltz, welcome back.
Thanks very much. I hope your listeners were actually listening to your last 90 seconds, because you had probably as good a summary of this situation, Todd, as I have ever heard anybody say.
Thank you.
It's really absolutely spot on. As you and I were discussing here, lots of stuff is happening right now. It's an amazing thing. The Gospel of Judas came out about a month ago. now the Da Vinci Code has been a publishing sensation. I mean, there's almost nothing like it in the history of publishing. The movie is about to hit on the 19th. Lots of publicity is surrounding that. The stars are on Jay Leno. Mm-hmm. And you just had a clip here, a quote from Dan Brown and so forth. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about that. I would like to say a little bit of something about the Gospel of Judas. But let's maybe begin today to ask just what's going on here. It is the most amazing thing where it's almost like giant revisionist history.
Before we get into that point, are you going to see the movie?
You know, well, this is an interesting thing.
Just picturing you sitting in a movie theater watching this and being... It must be on more than one level for you, Dr. Veltz, as right. a New Testament scholar, as someone who's concerned about the truth in general, as a Christian. I can anticipate that being a very frustrating experience.
Well, it would be, and I can tell you, I wouldn't be allowed to go with my wife, because I would be going, oh my gosh, what are they doing here? And she'd be poking me the whole while. Actually, your question is a very important question for our listeners. In the May 11th edition of the New York Times, there's a very interesting story entitled Christian Foes of Da Vinci Code Debate How to Fight It. And in the second paragraph, this is what the writer said. Some will boycott it. Others will use it as a teaching moment. Still others will lodge a protest by seeing another movie. Now, apparently, the acceptable movie to see in response is Over the Hedge.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah. So, but this is a very critical point as to what to do. Great little paragraph in this story just says this: Christians have not been this worked up about a movie since Martin Scorsese's Jesus stepped down off the crucifix in The Last Temptation of Christ in 1988, which, by the way, was a really bad movie. But this may or may not be good. I don't know. I've really got mixed feelings about whether to go to see it. Probably the best answer is this. I think maybe instead of seeing it and giving them the money in the theaters, there's going to have to be a video coming out. So see it with a whole bunch of friends so they don't get as much money for it.
Spread
the cost out a little bit. That's right.
Okay. Many things have come together. It's been kind of a conflagration of various ideas, challenges to traditional Christian history, to the very text of the New Testament themselves, and they've all kind of come to a head here with the publishing phenomena of the Da Vinci Code. Paint the landscape for us. Show us what you think the situation is as we sit down and talk about the Da Vinci Code today.
All right, that's good. I think there is a wider and a narrower focus. Let me read a quotation from Dan Brown on page 234 of the book. This would be the specifically narrow Da Vinci Code challenge. He says, the scrolls, and by that he means the Gnostic-type scrolls that have been discovered, highlight glaring historical discrepancies and falsifications, clearly confirming that the modern Bible was compiled and edited by men who possessed a political agenda to promote the divinity of the man Jesus Christ and use his influence to solidify their own power base. Now, that quotation brings up several important things. Number one, that there's been cover-up and falsification. Number two, that a select group of men did an election or selection process, a compilation and editing process. Thirdly, that it was as a result of a political agenda. Fourthly, that it promoted a specific view of Jesus as divine, whereas he was not, so that part was a lie. And that fifthly, then, that it was a power play move. Now, on just about every one of those points, you can raise simply devastating objections to it. And probably, Todd, I think this is the overwhelming frustration about this. It's just so hard to believe that something this full of holes, this badly Swiss cheese, it has legs, if I may put it that way. In that article in the New York Times I was referring to, they quote an official of the Vatican in Rome who says this, and I couldn't agree more. He says, if such slanders, offenses, and errors had been directed at the Quran or the Holocaust, there would have justly provoked a world uprising. Instead, directed at the church and Christians, they remain unpunished. And it is really, there is a kind of a PC, political correct factor to this, that somehow you can sort of attack Christianity and that's all right, but you can't attack these other things. As a matter of fact, it reminds me of the segment that you just had on the show and about the contribution of religion in general and the Judeo-Christian religion in particular to the founding of our country. I mean, it's kind of like this, that the whole Judeo-Christian approach has been the foundation and mainstay, and now we get to take some runs at it for a while.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, here is the established thing.
Yes.
And maybe this answers a question why it does have legs. Here is the established history, the accepted gospels, and in this day and age, part of our mentality is it's always nice to kind of question everything. And so we're going to question whether Matthew, Mark, and Luke are really the gospels that ought to be in there. We're going to question how they got there. We're going to question the very foundations of the Christian faith while we're at it. Okay, let's deal with the concerns one at a time.
Yeah. Before you get off of that, I think that's a very perceptive point and an important point. I think there is always a sort of perfect storm that arises when you get the confluence of postmodernism and American individualism. This is a really bad combo because Americans are inherently individualistic, iconoclastic, and everybody puts his pants on one leg at a time, that kind of thing. Postmodernism is going to, in its worst forms, is going to problematize everything, and it's going to see essentially politicizing suppression of opposing viewpoints. So if you can combine then the American suspicion of anything that reeks of superiority.
Institutional.
Plus the radical postmodern notion that everything's a power play and we suppress the things that we don't like. And and then add to that the notion of the divinity and humanity of Jesus, that there is just something, well, I mean, you know this as well as I do, offensive about the notion of the God-man Jesus Christ. And you get a kind of a lethal cocktail here.
Okay, let's go to the issue of the canon, the New Testament. You gave kind of the short story. Dan Brown claims, along with many others, he's just simply building on the works and speculation of others, that in the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea, Emperor Constantine, kind of newly Christian, decided that in order to consolidate his power and now the church that was his big club to use and big way of controlling the empire, he decided that they had to have one Christianity rather than all these competing Christianities, and more or less through consultation with the people there at the council, at least Dan Brown's version of it, they voted very narrowly to suppress all these competing voices in Christianity, and they were so good at it that they really left very little evidence that these things ever were really flourishing Christianity. What really happened? What was really the question of what belongs in the New Testament at the Council of Nicaea? What was Constantine's role?
Well, that's just way too late. I mean, you know, you're talking about early 4th century, Todd, you know, 325. As a matter of fact, when we talk about the canon, and I like the way you set the show up at the beginning, that what we have to talk about is what do Christians really need to know? what is it positively that we have to be able to confess to our neighbors and to our friends? Well, the fact of the matter is, this is almost so perversely wrong that you hardly know where to start, but let me just start with the first century. And that is, it is entirely likely, this isn't agreed to by everyone, but it's agreed to by a lot of people, it is entirely likely that our four Gospels, and Todd, I would include personally the Gospel of John, were all written before 70. That is to say, they were all written before the historical fall of Jerusalem. There doesn't seem to be any indication in the four Gospels of really a knowledge of that, and there's certainly no reference on the part of the Gospel writers to that particular phenomenon. Now, if they are written before 70, or let's say you even stretch it and take a more mild view, and you say they're written in the 70s to the 90s, we have our four Gospels written before 100. Now, it's easy enough to contend that there are 30 or 50 Gospels around by 300. Well, I would want to point out that if you want to make a claim like that, this is the way the claim should actually be stated. There are four at 70 or 90, and then there are 26 more later on, so by the time you get to 300, you've got 30. Mm-hmm. But this is a complete misrepresentation of the situation. As a matter of fact, there are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the clear testimony is we always had these four Gospels. They were never disputed by anyone. The technical term for this is homologumena, that is to say, people said the same thing about them. They were always professed. And we have manuscript evidence. This is actually quite unbelievable. We have a piece of manuscript of the Gospel of John that is reliably dated to about 125 A.D., a small fragment which resides in the John Rylands Library in the University of Manchester. So this is less than 100 years, and possibly if John's written later, more like 90, it's within 30 years of the writing of the Gospel. I mean, this is quite phenomenal, actually, if you look at it. Now, let's talk a little bit about the manuscript evidence for this for these Gospels. We have a couple of very early manuscripts that are, from 200 or before. And there's one interesting tripartite piece that we have. There's a manuscript P, that stands for papyrus. That's the material it's written on. Papyrus 4, papyrus 64, and papyrus 67 are not three different manuscripts. It turns out they got separated and they're all the same. Now, if you put this together, you start to find out by the way the manuscript is formed and by actual pagination that there are enough pages and enough supposed pages that there are four Gospels. And we have fragments of Mark, and we have fragments of Luke, and we know there's something we have fragments of Matthew and Luke. We know there's something after Matthew, and we know that there's something after Luke. So we've got this very early piece of evidence of the four Gospels, and the amazing thing is, I think most of our people, most of our students before they come to the seminary, don't know this next point I'm going to tell you, that the Gospels standardly circulate together as four together, like this tripartite manuscript is. So one of the big lies about the canon is something like this. It sounds like a technical point, but it's actually very important. It's not true that there are 20, 30, 50 Gospels all circulating independently, and then people are just picking a few out. You know, if you saw that show on the Gospel of Judas, it shows Irenaeus sitting there with some scrolls and taking them out and throwing them on the floor and stuff like that. Well, A, they wouldn't have been in scrolls. They were only in a codex, a book form. The Christians The Christians popularized the codex form. Everybody else used scrolls.
The way we think about a book. Which is bound in pages one after another.
Right.
The Christians were the ones who
popularized that. All the stuff is standardly in a book, whereas everybody else is using scrolls. And so we have these bound together, and it could well be so that the Gospels can be bound together. In other words, they seem to be circulating as four. Now, here's the important point. You never get four, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Gospel of Peter, or Matthew, Gospel of Thomas, Luke, and Gospel of Mary or something. You never get that. You always get these four circulating together. So just the very notion that you could have something like the Gospel of Judas being a contender in a big pile of scrolls or something like that is simply not historical and does not reflect the way... I'm going to use a phrase now that was used by Kurt Olland many years ago in a very fine little pamphlet he did on the canon of the New Testament. He said this. I always quote this to my class. He said, the books of the New Testament, and right now we're talking about the Gospels, so I'll use it for that, impressed themselves upon the church. The church never saw any reason not to accept them, and they never saw any reason to question them.
So this is really goes to kind of the way we describe the event of the formation of the canon. The church from first century on through whenever they finally said, okay, here's the New Testament, or here's the canon of the New Testament scriptures. The church saw itself as recognizing these books rather than evaluating them, voting on them, taking a consensus, something like that. They recognized them for what they considered them to be rather than saying, okay, I think we'll confer the status of Scripture on this thing.
That's the right way to say it. They recognized it. They didn't confer the status. Another way to say it is this way. They always describe this as being handed down. It was always handed on to us. Now, you remember that in a number of places in St. Paul's letters, you get this formulation, I handed on to you what I also received. That's the Christian way to do things. You hand on the things that you receive. It's not like we've got a big pile of stuff and now we sift through it and we confer status on that. Now, as a matter of fact, I think it's important in this discussion to go to the Pauline epistles because they are actually earlier. Paul wrote the epistles essentially in the 50s, so they would have been written essentially between 54 and the late 50s, possibly 60, something like that. Gospels may be that early, but Paul is certainly that early. And the Pauline epistles were all gathered very early. Some people even think, Todd, and I think this is just a very interesting idea. Some people even think that Paul gathered the epistles himself and assembled them as a collection because we do have evidence of people like Cicero and other people in the ancient world who did gather their own letters. As a matter of fact, apparently the ancient letter writers kept copies, sort of like keeping a carbon or something like that. They kept copies of what they had sent so that they'd be able to assemble a collection. Now, here's why this is important. The 13 epistles of Paul circulate as a unit called the Apostolicon, that is to say, the apostolic book. Epistles of Paul circulate as a unit. The four Gospels, the Megalion, the big book, circulate as a unit. Now, Todd, what everybody who's listening to this program has got to realize and understand, and it probably if they come away only with this point this afternoon, this will be really key, that the Apostolicon, the Pauline epistles, and the Megalion, the collection of the four Gospels, circulated together, was accepted, was just received early on. It's got to be by the early second century. It's got to be. Well, in fact, we know Paul's accepted earlier than that because people are quoting Paul like the letters of Ignatius and so on early on. So you have two-thirds, let's describe it like that, three-quarters maybe of the New Testament is circulating in two big collections already within 50 to 100 years of the stuff being written.
Before we go to this break, let's take a quick phone call. This one from Jim, who's calling from his car. And our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Because I'm getting pretty far out. I just basically got a comment, you know, and, you know, the Scripture teaches us there's one faith, and it teaches us that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the Word of God. So no matter what comes out new and stuff, it really can't shake the faith of the people who's truly in the faith because they know the nonsense of it because they know there's a sovereign God who controls this whole universe that brings about everything, and surely he can bring us the Word down through the ages. That would be the simplest thing for him to do.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. We've only got about a minute, in fact, less than a minute, Dr. Veltz. Go to the mindset of the early Christians. Is that reflected in what Jim had to say there? That you said they always talked about it as things being handed down to them, and this idea that while we in the 21st century say, well, how could God preserve these documents? For them, it was happening every day.
Yes.
They were the ones preserving them because they took them that seriously.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Think of that great throwaway line in 2 Thessalonians 2. Paul says, this is one of my favorite passages. He says, don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? Well, they had a living voice that they knew. The things that were written were absolutely confirming of that. And they confessed then this message that they received and in which they stood. And as the caller said, the message which is the very Word of God.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. James Veltz, professor of New Testament and director of graduate studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're talking about the canonical Gospels versus the Gnostic Gospels. We will talk about the Gnostic Gospels, and we'll take your phone calls, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Veltz will be one of the speakers for a special presentation titled Discernment for Da Vinci tomorrow night at 7 at Werner Auditorium here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. We'll be right back with another half hour. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.